that we've had inflationary pressures throughout our history. Because when you work for full employment, when you achieve full employment, there's obviously a greater pressure on goods and services, and so pressure on prices. But the interesting thing about the 8 years that, when Mr. Nixon was vice president and the last 8 years of Democratic administrations is that we've had about the same amount of inflation in each of the 8 year periods, but in the Nixon years we had unemployment on top of it. Unemployment went up from 2 to 5 million in that period. And today, in spite of about the same amount of inflation, Americans are much greater off, and here in Ohio, for example, real incomes are 30% higher in 1968 than they were in 1960. And so our philosophy has been to achieve full employment so that everybody who's able to work has a job, and a decent paying job. And all of this has been done at reduced taxes. Corporations and individuals in America are paying $16 billion less a year in taxes than they would be if we had the rates that were in effect in 1960 to dampen the pressures brought on largely by the war, as well as the growing employment. And the two things are, one, the temporary tax increase, which still leaves us with lower taxes, but tends to control inflation. And we've also reduced government spending this year under the president's budget as he presented it last January. And both of these ought to have the effect, and I think is having the effect of reducing the inflationary pressures.
I can't recall a presidential campaign, Senator, where so much emphasis has been placed upon the vice presidency. I read more, I hear more. As a matter of fact, in your own campaigns, and particularly the campaign for Mr. Humphrey, I hear more emphasis being placed on the fact that you are the vice presidential candidate for the Democrats and how much more important that is for people to consider than perhaps considering Mr. Agnew.
Well, I think that's in part due to the tragic events beginning with President Kennedy's assassination. Under our laws, has very little authority. The Vice President presides over the Senate, and he stands next in line to the President in succession. But beyond that, his tasks are whatever the President gives him to do. And this part of his work has grown under Mr. Eisenhower and Mr. Kennedy and Mr. Johnson. And the Vice President has in mind giving me a great deal of work and authority in the field of our domestic problems. The domestic role of the federal government has grown tremendously, of course. We have over 200, almost 300 grant and aid programs designed to help state and local governments do their jobs better.
And President Humphrey, should you win?
Well, first of all, of course, I suppose any candidate for vice president wants to feel that he's making a contribution to the ticket. Mm-hmm. And that's my first reaction to it. Secondly, because I'm relatively a new face to most people at the grassroots level in the country, I suppose they're focusing more on what they think is favorable than what may be unfavorable. I've got my shortcomings too, and they'll appear, and I'll begin to get criticism. I've been in politics long enough to know that that will happen. Thirdly, I would hope that if this favorable reaction continues, and if we're elected, I hope that this will strengthen our capacity as a team to do the job. The vice president, you see, has been in public office a long time, really no longer than I have, in a sense, but
nationally,
that is, and he was involved in those pre-convention primary contests and the controversy at the convention. So the people haven't, until recently, haven't really focused on what he is, as they did before. And as they get to know him, these closing days and his presence, they're going to find him, as I do, a very attractive, able, intelligent, compassionate human being. And I think you're going to see him rise in the esteem of this country as presidents with that capacity for leadership have risen before, men like Kennedy and Truman and Roosevelt. Remember, Kennedy won with less than the majority vote, and yet he reached, I think, something like 85% popularity in his presidency. So I think the same thing will happen with the vice president. If I can contribute to that and the approval of his administration, that to me will be the greatest dividend of whatever reaction the country has to me.
Senator, I know you're on a very tight schedule. One final question. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to comment on the situation in Vietnam and the new, large amount would be a way of putting it, of rumors going on about the possibility of a bomb halt and the possibility of more accomplishment in the peace talks. Could you comment on that and maybe give us your feelings on it?
Well, I'm sure I share the feelings of all Americans, the feeling of hope that there's beginning to be movement toward the peace table, because I do know something of the details of what is going on. I can't speak freely about it. I wouldn't want at this point or at any point to jeopardize it. But what we've been looking for is some indication that the North Vietnamese too want to negotiate a settlement. We haven't really known this, you see. And until we know it, and until they give us some reassurance on this point. The hope for movement has always been sort of vague and up in the air. So I hope that as a result of what has been going on, that we can move. I don't know that we're going to yet. I haven't got any final fixed information on that point. And I assume if there were any, it would be interrupting every television program in the country.
Isn't that true? Senator, I appreciate your taking time between you and the Republican Party. Will this surge be enough? Is it on schedule?
Well, I'm sure it isn't scheduled. If we'd been in a position to schedule it, we wouldn't have called it quite so close. But I think it is. It can be enough. Well, it will be enough. I don't have the crystal ball to say, but it's just it's the difference between night and day. The feeling 3 weeks ago, let's say, and the feeling today. Everywhere we go, and I've been, as I said today in Cincinnati, I've been across the country since last Saturday in Minnesota, in Wyoming, in Utah, in Oregon, in Washington, California, Texas, Tennessee, and Kentucky, and uniformly you feel this brilliancy is a good word to put it.
Well, Senator, why? Why is this happening?
Well, I think that you have to have a certain period in every campaign when the issues are discussed, the war, law and order, and all the rest of it. And there's been all of this, and the candidates have beat all those subjects to death, you see. Now, people are beginning to concentrate on the fact that what's involved is the election of a president. And as they concentrate on that, the issue becomes the man more and more. Sure, the issues are still important, but they're now concentrating on the man. And as they consider the choices, of course, this is a prejudiced personal point of view, but as they consider the choices, the qualities of Hubert Humphrey are more and more engaging their attention and their interest, and I think going to get their votes.
Senator, I wonder if we could be a bit more specific. I think in this campaign there has been some criticism that specifics have been hard to come by on the part of many of the candidates. I wonder if we can talk about what you consider, as the man who should know, are the key states that you must have if your team is going to win the presidency.
Well, I leave that kind of analysis to the armchair strategist back in Washington. I'm busy going where they send me. Obviously, we need all the states we can get, and I think the picture as to the possibilities constantly changes. For instance, we're in Texas this week, and Senator Yarbo told me that in mid-October there was nothing doing in Texas for us at all, nothing going at all. But we had a marvelous day in Texas the day before yesterday. And it's his feeling now that we're going to carry Texas. Now, on facts his judgment is based, I don't know, but I know it's based at least in part upon this great surge of interest. And so the Texas picture has changed. New York, inside of a week, in the New York Daily News poll, we came from 2 points down to 4 points ahead. And I understand the picture's even better. So as the picture changes, you have to watch every state and travel around the road. I can't watch all 50 states to answer a question like that.
Senator, I wonder if you've had any white paper or any briefing as it relates to what your people think George Wallace may wind up with as a percentage of the total vote.
I don't know who he'll wind up with. I think that the country's interest would be best served if he could be driven below 10%, because he has no chance to be president. That's clear. And I think this is an important point to make to your viewers, that the real choice is between Humphrey and Nixon, and they ought not to throw their vote away on a Wallace candidacy. They ought to select one of these two, because we ought to try to decide this election on November 5th and not throw it into the House of Representatives and have a long period of weeks of uncertainty and unrest and fear in the country as to what the outcome would be. But and so this is terribly important, I think, to make this choice on next Tuesday.
Senator McCarthy has begun actively campaigning in the West for the Democratic National ticket. How much of a difference should that make?
Well, the how much question is an awfully hard one to answer. A lot of McCarthy...
Will it make a difference?
Oh, I'm sure it will. A lot of McCarthy people had come over to us increasingly and in great numbers before he made his statement. And as a matter of fact, he indicated his understanding of this fact in his statement. But nevertheless, he's the visible symbol of that movement. And for him to make his statement creates the impression of growing party unity, which is a fact, and which helps in these closing days. How much it will help, it'll take the analysts weeks after the election to decide.
Senator, you've been quoted as saying that even if you do not come out in a victorious manner on November 5th, you would like to be sure you have said some things which are important, which are meaningful. Are you satisfied the other major candidates have adopted the same attitude?
Well, every candidate has to do what he thinks he needs to. My criticism of Wallace, of course, is that he's tried to play to the fears and suspicions and distrust of Americans for each other. And that's no way for a president to build a great country. I think a president's task is to bring out the best in his people, not the worst in his people. And so whether or not he's done this as a matter of conviction or expediency, only he knows, and I'm not going to get into his motives. But whatever his motives, his message is wrong for the country. As far as Mr. Nixon is concerned, he was so anxious to win that he decided there was a tide of protest great enough to carry him in, and that he could rely on that and coast to victory. And so he hasn't asserted that duty of leadership to seek a positive mandate and use the election campaign itself to try to bring out the best in the American people. He too stirred up the protest instead of trying to generate the creative, clean, decent sentiments of the American people.
Senator, you keep repeating this. You say there is a need to bring out the best in the American people to solve the crises which we have. Why has the best not been brought out in us before? We're just getting through a Democratic administration. Why the need now for the best?
Well, I disagree. We have done a great deal to bring out the best in the American people. It's the record of the past 8 years and what we've been able to build into our public policies and programs to deal with the problems of the cities and race relations and all these things. We've done a great deal. But on the question of what does it take to bring out the best, it's a challenge. I mean, all of us are human beings. The citizen who has no public office is no different than I, no worse, no better. But we all need challenge, the stimulus of challenge to do our best. You know, it's an old cliche of American history that average men have been elected president and have grown into the office to become great presidents. And Harry Truman is often held out as a classic example of this sort of thing. Well, every citizen has the same capacity to rise above what he thinks himself, the limits of what he can do, if he's challenged to do it, if he's given the facts, if the alternatives are pointed out, and if the appeal is made. Every fundraiser drive in every community is an example of this. I used to be a fundraiser in non-political drives before I got into politics. And every fund drive used to start off very slowly. People were very slow to respond. But if the campaign was organized to really appeal to their generous instincts in an effective way, till the end, they always rose to the challenge and went over the top. You watch these fund drives. That's the way it always goes.
Senator, you've said that perhaps in the early part of the campaign was the time when it was difficult to delineate issues. But I wonder if we might review some of these just for a moment. And I wonder if you would give us your impression of what has been the single most difficult point you have tried to make in this campaign and your evaluation of how successful you've been.
Well, that's a difficult question to answer in itself. I think the vice president's most difficult problem, and so it became part of my responsibility to deal with it too, was to demonstrate that he had his own political identity, and that as a team, we represented something different than President Johnson's administration, or President Eisenhower's administration, or President Kennedy's administration. In other words, the country wanted to believe that we had a political being of our own, Now, a lot of gimmicks were suggested, you know, to deal with this kind of a problem. And I've always felt that the way you establish your own identity is to do it in a positive way. Tell people what you stand for, what your record represents, what you propose to do. And that's what we've concentrated on, and I think that's beginning to come through and is part of the answer in these closing days to our rising surge.
I wonder if you would tick off a few of these issues, law and order, Vietnam, the domestic situation, etc., and just give us a capsule comment on what you consider to be the major three or four issues in this campaign.
Well, I think the most important issue is none of those you've mentioned. I think the most important issue is a question to be decided in the hearts and minds of every American citizen, whether or not they really want to try to work together and to trust and to work for every other American, whatever the color of his skin or his origin or his region. That's the big question, because you can't operate a society like this except on the basis of basic trust. Oh, we're all human and we're going to have fears and suspicions and distrusts. I'm not talking about saints, but I'm talking about the need, ultimately, in this society to come down hard on the basis of trusting, basically trusting your fellow Americans. And I think the cause of most of the unrest has been the fear on the part of too many Americans, maybe of all Americans, that maybe the old basis for trust is gone, and that from now on we're going to have a society divided and torn by its fears and suspicions. But I don't think that has to be, if the individual citizen answers that question the right way in this election year.
Senator, are you saying now that we are in this country at a crossroads and we choose a path to follow?
I think so, and the choice is really here rather than at the polling booth. Now, I happen to the polling booth is important too, because the kind of leadership we get in the next 4 years is going to have a lot to do with our own reaction to this problem. But I think the individual American has got to just sit down hard and decide. Is it better to try to build an America in which Americans trust each other, or an America in which Americans fear each other? Now, fear is no basis upon which to build freedom.
Senator, are we at a crossroads in regard to Vietnam? Could you shed some light on where we stand in Vietnam right now?
Well, I'm not at liberty to tell you anything more than the papers are telling you at this point. The story is unfolding. What the climax will be, we're just going to have to wait.
Could you tell us if you expect further developments? Are they imminent?
Well, that I couldn't answer either at this point.
Senator, to return just for a moment to this point you were just making so eloquently, and I think every American would agree with it, that if we're going to live together successfully, we have to do it in some trust. I wonder if you could give us some idea how we're going to accomplish this trust. How are we going to, I believe, restore this trust that you have indicated you believe has eroded to some degree?
Well, of course, we understand what the problems are. The affluent American, the American who's worked hard for his stake in life, now fears that those who don't have one are threatening him and what he's worked hard to build up. The deprived American, the disadvantaged American is fearful that the affluent American is so selfishly concentrating upon what he's got that he doesn't want to share America's opportunities with him. The people in the central cities who have to bear the burden of services and employment for the people in the suburbs but live themselves in a deteriorating environment don't believe that the suburbs are really concerned about the life in the city or improving it. I mean, it's this kind of division between Americans. So, in part, you can restore confidence by dealing with these problems of the central cities and of law and order, effective law enforcement agencies, dealing with the social causes, providing jobs for those who are in situations where job opportunities are not available, decent homes. This sort of thing government can help to do, but private enterprise has to get involved too, because it's too big a job for one level of government or for government or the private sector to do alone. And so we've got to put together more effective programs for doing these things. And so that's part of the evidence we can give of our concern for each other. But really what has to come through is the kind of trust that you get in the day-to-day relationships of people in a community. People in their communities have got to go out of their way to communicate, to integrate, to work together, to build together, and to trust each other. It's got to come out there. It's got to come out through the churches and the schools. American public life isn't created in Washington. It's created in the neighborhoods. And the only thing that makes a good neighborhood is good neighbors. And Whether or not neighbors are good neighbors depends upon the individual neighbor, the individual human being.
Senator, we have about a minute left, and perhaps this is unfair to do. But political hecklers seem to be having their heyday this year. Most people say you have handled them better than the other major candidates. Do you suppose you're winning many of them over to your side? I know you have given some of them the opportunity to speak.
Well, four have actually accepted, and each one has been a very interesting and rather dramatic incident. And every one of those four has either afterwards indicated his or her support for me or indicated a greater receptiveness to the ticket, so that it's with respect to the particular participants, it's been good. And I think that it has established communications with the college youngsters of the country that has been very reassuring to me.
So you're saying that something constructive could come out of these hecklers?
Oh, yes. Of course, there are those who don't want to do anything constructive, but I'm talking about the great majority of decent American youngsters. They want to do something good. They want to be constructive. They're deeply troubled about these problems. And all they want to be assured of is that there is someone who will listen. Not only that, but respond and give them a part to play in this great society.
Senator, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Americana Hotel, October 31, 1968. New York State Democratic Committee dinner meeting.
Fruition of delicate negotiations over the past two or three weeks. And apparently the package has been put together so that he's willing to take the risk and is reasonably assured there'll be no risk to our fighting forces of stopping the bombing in the interests of moving together with the other side toward substantive negotiations. The puzzling questions have revolved about the point as to whether or not Hanoi and the NLF are really committed to a negotiated settlement of the war in their own interests. They've never said so, and we've looked for evidence on the point. Apparently, the President is satisfied that there is enough evidence to warrant taking this action. I would agree with the President in his caution that this doesn't mean peace tomorrow. Indeed, it suggests no time schedule as to when further steps may be taken. There will be hard and difficult points to negotiate once the parties are seated around the conference table. Difficult points related to such things as a ceasefire, a transition government, the composition of the transition government, free elections, the safeguards for such elections, the kind of government to be decided by such elections, the safeguards for that government. These and other hard points will be negotiated if we in fact move toward substantive talks and if in fact neither side undertakes to take military advantage of the fact that such talks are underway. But at the very least, what we have tonight is movement in the right direction. Movement that I think will be heartily approved by the great majority of the American people. And I pray tonight that their prayers for real movement, real negotiation and settlement of the political problems of Vietnam will result in what is being announced tonight. I know I will be asked, as I have been many times in recent days, what the political significance of these developments may be. Well, may I assure you with all the sincerity at my command that I don't care. Secondly, that I don't know. I'm certain of only one thing, that in common with all Americans, I want to see that war ended with reasonable safeguards. With reasonable safeguards for the right of all of the South Vietnamese people to decide their own course in the years ahead. And I don't minimize the importance of this question to the American people. But I think it's also important to focus on other issues which are at stake in this election campaign. 2 or 3 weeks ago, I had the privilege of speaking to a luncheon group in Philadelphia of people who were described to me as Kennedy and McCarthy followers, who had met to endorse the Humphrey Muskie ticket. Unexpectedly, I had the opportunity of hearing another American address the group before I did, an American by the name of Bayard Rustin. And he made 2 points. First, that he was as concerned as anyone in the room about the issue of the war, and that his record was clear on that subject. But that secondly, in his judgment, this election has far greater significance for another reason than the war. And he likened it to the election of 1876. He reminded me and all of us in that room that that election laid the basis for race relations in this country up to the present time. The hearts and the minds, the skills and the know-how, the organizational ability, the managerial skills of a free people, in a climate of freedom, we built this economic strength. We've done it by building one country, the only kind of an America that has ever made any sense. This is by the nature of America. And in the process, we found it possible to bring in everyone who wanted to enter here. We've answered to the age-old problem of creating harmony in a society is to divide that society by fear and hatred. His is the age-old answer that's never worked except to produce explosions, which jeopardize the security of every member of a society. But we also have 2 other candidates, and what they represent has a good deal to do with the question of whether or not we continue to build an America for the development of our people or not. Both Mr. Nixon and Mr. Humphrey were leading representatives of administration, which governed the policies of our country over a similar 8-year period. Mr. Nixon was vice president in the period for whose policies he said in his campaign he's ready to be fully accountable. Well, let's hold him accountable. In those 8 years, we had 3 recessions. The cost is $175 billion. But we can expect the same policies in the next 4 years if he's elected President of the United States. How else do you judge him? He was a congressman for 6 years. Faced with the question of rebuilding our cities and making them livable places of opportunity, needs a president who stands for something and whose record proves he stands. Richard Nixon has had 25 years of public service to prove what he stands for. And I say to you that it wasn't good enough in 1960. It wasn't good enough for California in 62, and it isn't good enough for us. Nixon said that John Kennedy was running on a platform that would spend the American people. Well, you can't do it by passing a law. You can't do it by pressing. And that's to do it in the hearts and minds of every American citizen in this country from coast to coast. And it all revolves around the question of whether we're going to fear each other or trust each other. It's as simple as that. And by trust, I don't mean trusting the fellow who works in your office. I mean taking a chance on any American. Whoever he is, wherever he lives, whatever the color of his skin, whatever his origin or economic class, that's what I mean by trust. Taking a chance on any American and giving him an equal chance to take a chance on you. They tell me that the issues in this campaign are the war, or law and order, or rebuilding our cities, or race relations. There's only one issue in this campaign that amounts to anything in terms of our future capacity to build a country. That is the question of whether or not Americans are going to be willing to take a chance on each other in the future. I've analyzed the American people's fears and suspicions and distrust, and we have them. All of us. When my wife or kids go out on the streets of a great city, I'm as fearful as anyone in this room that harm may come to them. And when I send them among strangers, I wonder as much as anyone in this room whether they would be safe. But they won't be safe if I let myself be governed by my fear. They won't be safe if I let my fears run away with me so that I'll try to build walls between them and other Americans. That doesn't work. For 180 years, we've proven that in spite of all our weaknesses and doubts from time to time, that the basic willingness to trust works. And what bothers Americans today, I don't care whether they're the suburban Americans who fled there for security, or black Americans, or white Americans, or who they are. What disturbs every one of them is the fear. The gut feeling that we've reached the point in our development when from now on Americans are going to fear each other more than they trust each other. That's the issue of this campaign. That's the issue of our time. And it's an issue that the founders anticipated. Jefferson anticipated. Foreign observers like de Tocqueville anticipated. Because they understood that when you finally developed into a crowded society, the individual would feel less significant and would feel less supported. I understand. We have just one choice. And I say it to you white Americans. I say it to you black Americans. I say it to you poor Americans. I say it to you affluent Americans. If there's only one thing that's going to make this election come out right, that's a decision on the part of most Americans that once more they're willing to take a chance on each other and help each other. Respond to the call for greatness in this election. I think they're going to respond to the call for greatness in the years ahead. And let me tell you that whether I'm part of that America, as a vice president, or as a senator, or as a citizen, I'm going to be in the middle of that fight, and I invite you to do the same.
This country has ever seen. I don't think anybody likes to spend money any better than Hubert Humphrey does. And I think that's one of the reasons this year that we in the Republican Party are so conscious of the need to change the course of this country and to do something about the awesome wave of inflation that's causing our incomes and our retirement values to shrivel. Hubert said in 1950, while he was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I know that's a long time ago, but I guess you have to be hung with these things anyhow. The welfare state is a legitimate objective, one that's consistent with our traditions and with the current wishes of the American people. That was Hubert Humphrey in 1950. Yet just a few days ago at Seal Beach, California, Hubert Humphrey says, "We don't want a welfare state in this country." And I say, will the real Hubert Humphrey please stand up? You know, it's only been a few days ago that Arnold Chase, who is the Deputy Commissioner of the Labor Department's Bureau of Labor Statistics, said that the cost of living predicted for 1968 will be the highest increase in 17 years. And I tell you, we can't stand much more of that type of unpriority spending that the Johnson-Humphrey administration has launched us toward. I don't think that when you consider that Eisenhower left a balanced budget to the Democratic Party, and that now we have a deficit of $61 billion, we have a rate of inflation of 6% a year. We have exhausted our international trade surplus, which was $5.5 billion when Eisenhower left office. And we have a population in this country, since Ike, that's up 10%, but we have a population of the federal government that's up 20%. And the cost of staffing the federal government is up 50%. And the budget since Eisenhower left office is up 94%. I say that's fiscal irresponsibility, and when you look at the spending programs, you quickly understand why this happens. It isn't that we shouldn't spend for a better America. It isn't that we shouldn't invest in our people. Each of us knows we have to do that. But some of the waste that's going on within the federal government is so dramatic that it becomes immediately apparent to even the most casual observer that we cannot pursue this course that Hubert Humphrey has led us to. Take the OEO programs in certain areas. One of the most dramatic faux pas ever made by the OEO program was the assignment of some $900,000 in anti-poverty funds to two Chicago street gangs. Well, they didn't spend the whole $974,000. They stopped them when they'd only spent $714,000 of your tax money. And the director of the OEO got up before a Senate committee less than 3 weeks ago and said, yes, this was a terrible mistake. But we can't have those kind of mistakes. When we need to conserve our money to prevent the wave of inflation that's taking money out of retired people's pockets, we cannot have that kind of selective experimentation that doesn't have a reasonable chance of success. And Richard Nixon says that under his administration, you're not going to see any of that type of waste. The Democrats are pulling their old scare tactic again about Social Security, so I guess I'd better put that thing to rest. Nixon does not stand against Social Security or Medicare. He's voted consistently as a congressman and as a senator and supported these programs as vice president. As a matter of fact, Nixon advocates for Social Security, cost of living increases, And these have to come about only because the tremendous inflationary spiral has robbed the Social Security Trust Fund of $2.5 billion of your retirement money. Nixon also wants to change the widow's allotment to be 100% of the deceased husband's benefit instead of the 82% limitation that we're now faced with. We don't see any reason why widows should get a worse deal than widowers. And most important, Social Security needs to be revamped to permit people who want to be gainfully employed and who can be gainfully employed to earn more money even though they're reaping the benefits of their retirement. We want to encourage the older citizen to be a productive, useful citizen for most of his life. These are the changes that Nixon advocates. Humphrey comes up with some vague program of increasing Social Security 50%. Why, his programs are so outrageous that, taking a quick total on them, he'd have to spend $50 billion next year just to begin to implement them. I don't know where that money's coming from. Neither does anyone else. Now look at the farmers' plight under the Johnson-Humphrey administration. The farmer is the only person in this country that buys everything at retail and sells everything at wholesale. Since 1960, and incidentally, the average of parity during the Eisenhower years was about 84. It's now down to 74.